This episode is brought to you by Home Team Inspection Service. When you partner with Home Team, you're getting more than a home inspection. You're delivering the home team experience. With a team approach, fast turnarounds, and package options that include home inspection warranties, Home Team helps real estate pros stand out. Plus, many locations now offer pay at close, giving your clients flexibility when they need it most. Schedule your next inspection with confidence at hometeam.com.
We have a number of bathrooms in the house that I'm in right now in this house. Like, when you're in a hut living in a refugee camp, there is no bathroom. You're using outside. There's no clean water. It is so different from life here as I know it that I sometimes struggle to even believe that it's the same body that I'm in that experienced that.
Welcome to the Color of Money podcast. My name's Bowman Keady, and I'm joined by my amazing hosts, Julia Lachey, Daniel Dixon, and Emric Peace. We have an extremely, extremely special episode for you today. We are joined by the one and only Maui Askadom. This guy is going to be quite a special guest. His journey from a refugee, Ethiopian refugee camp to Harvard University, to becoming a best-selling author, a pioneering social entrepreneur. His story has inspired millions of people around our country and around the globe. He spent 3 years in a refugee camp before resettling to the United States. He faced language barriers, financial struggles, personal tragedy and loss in his family. But with the support of educators, mentors, and other people, he gained confidence and resilience and has spent the rest of his life trying to give that back to young people and to adults around this country. Just to give you some little tidbit of scope, this guy's one of my personal heroes, one of my closest friends, was the best man in my wedding, but that's not that impressive in the scope of what this guy's done. He's spoken to thousands of audiences, including McKinsey, Boston Consulting Group, Bank of America, Chase. He's one of the top public speakers in the country. Essence named him one of the 40 most inspirational African Americans in the United States. And our very own Oprah Winfrey marked her interview with him as one of the top 20 moments ever on the Oprah Winfrey Show. Maui Askadom.
Woo!
Wow, bro. I got to bring you around, bro. Man.
That is great.
So we are super excited to have you, Maui. And I didn't even get into your experience building Maui Learning. Maui built an online learning company, which had a great impact and which he sold to the global nonprofit ACT in 2019. So we're going to talk to him a little bit about that. But starting off, Maui, just tell us a little bit about your story. And I know you've spent a lot of time talking about your story, but it's so powerful. Just tell us a little bit about how you got to be who you are today.
Yeah, well, thank you both for that amazing intro. And what an honor to be here with y'all. We're going to have a lot of fun. Thank you for having me. And I really look forward to this. And I love that you're doing this. And, you know, it's interesting. I've told my story a lot of different ways. I haven't really told it from the perspective of wealth building and also like entrepreneurship in the way that y'all help the community grow and understand. So I'm really excited by that. And, you know, my story is I'm from about the most remote place you can imagine. It's funny, you can find anything on Google Maps now. So I was like, let me type in my little village where I'm from in Ethiopia, in Tigray. And it's Adiwala. I mean, if anybody wants to do it, it's A-D-I, then W-A-H-L-A in Tigray, Ethiopia. And it's hard for me to believe that's where I'm from. It's out in the middle of nowhere, tiny little village. It's a small city in a remote province, okay? Not even a city, it's like a village. Well, there was a war there for 30 years. And during that war, my family became refugees and fled to Sudan, where over a million Ethiopian refugees fled to. And that's why I think, Bo, you're out in the DC area. That's also known as Little Addis, I think, by some. Yeah. And a lot of the Ethiopians there came because of that war. You know, we became refugees. My family was in Sudan. And the thing that I think is really interesting, I think about it when I tell my kids this, is like, hey, we have a number of bathrooms in the house that I'm in right now in this house. Like, when you're in a hut living in a refugee camp, there is no bathroom. You're using outside with no toilet paper. So y'all use your imagination for years, right? There's no clean water. You are literally going to the well, getting the water, but then boiling the water every time you drink it because there's parasites that can kill you. So it's a level of, it is so different from life here as I know it that I sometimes struggle to even believe that it's the same body that I'm in that experienced that. And I'm here right now, right? But that kind of anchored, I think, my earlier life in the sense of, yeah, life can be really hard sometimes. And yet
I'm surrounded by these incredibly brave, courageous adults that make it seem like, yeah, we're going to be fine. And that's one of the greatest gifts that I think the adults gave me around me, the other refugees, my mom, my dad, was that sense of we're going to make it through here and it's going to be okay. And we're going to find our way somehow in this country where we don't know anybody. And we got lucky enough to be resettled to the US. When we came, I mean, you're coming with literally just what you have with you, which is nothing, right? So it's not even possible to talk about the kind of wealth building you guys are talking about in terms of money, all that kind of stuff, because you just don't have money, okay? There's no money. There's no, nobody has money. There's no money anywhere. You can't get money. That's like, you're used to being poor all the time. All the time, right? So that's, I think that's one of the things that surprised Bo when we were roommates at Harvard was, I think one of the years we roomed together, I think I spent like $20 the whole year because I was just used to like not spending money. I ate all my meals in the dining hall. Like I didn't buy any clothes. Like I came back from the holiday break one time and I saw one of my classmates with like 8 bags from random stores. I was like, oh, do people do that over the holidays? They're like, they go and they buy a lot of stuff. And so it's just, I'm not saying this. I want you guys to like feel sorry for me or think that I thought there was something wrong with me. It's just, that's what the reality was. That's what it was, right?
A lot of people think scarcity is a limitation in their life. Now, how did you turn that scarcity mindset into a source of like creativity and strength and success?
Well, glad you asked that question, man. This guy's a genius, man. Okay, Daniel Dixon, thank you. So I actually brought something I don't share very often, but it seems like a simple box, but it's something that's pretty sacred to me. What it is it has a business card that my older brother, who passed away when he was in high school, he started his own business. We were living in Section 8 housing. There were 6 of us living on, like, I'd say maybe $1,000 a month. And wow. My dad was legally blind at the time. My mom had a minimum wage job.
Wow.
But he started this business. I would consider that to be an act of tremendous creativity and ingenuity to say, hey, I'm broke right now. And I remember going to strip malls with my brother and him literally knocking on, it was a business called ProClean. It was a cleaning business. He would literally, like, would go to strip malls and just knock on each office and say, hey, can I clean your office? I'll come in once a week for $40. And I would go with him to clean that office, right? And I saw the magical moment for me was, and this may not seem like a lot of money to your listeners, but my brother is a high school student, made over $1,000 one month from doing this, which blew my mind. It was like he'd made $10 million. I'm like, what? He made $1,000. And one time I had dinner with some folks who help run AEI, American Enterprise Institute. And one of the things they shared with me is a lot of their research shows that if you've not met an entrepreneur, if you met an entrepreneur and actually known them, the chances that you become an entrepreneur are like 70 or 80% more likely. So even though it was just a humble little business that didn't make much money, I was there with my brother to see him go to the printer and say, for $25, give me this box. He didn't even have an LLC or anything like that. They just put it in his personal account. He was able to create something out of nothing. And that's why right when I graduated from Harvard, all the other kids who graduated from Harvard, you know, they work at a place like McKinsey, BCG, all that kind of stuff. I immediately went to a very similar printer, paid him $25 and started my own business, which people thought I was crazy. Like, well, I was 22, 23. I said, I'm gonna start my own business. But I had that example of my brother doing that. And a lot of people, when you say create, you said abundance out of scarcity, you can also create inspiration out of just horror. So it was complete horror when my brother was killed by a drunk driver. When he was a senior and I was a sophomore, and you come to this country, survive everything. And then he was actually on the way to a church event to see his old Sunday school teacher away. And so that's the hardest thing that ever happened to me in my life was losing my brother. But it's also been the biggest source of inspiration counterintuitively because I was then inspired by his example.
And so like some of us, we grew up in America. We can't say we were that broke. And I noticed I didn't say poor. I said that broke. Because the difference in broke, poor is a state of mind, broke is a state of your bank account. So we weren't that broke. So when you're having that conversation, you're talking about moving from unknown to even further unknown. Language barrier, because a lot of times we talk about people come here to America and they make this life for themselves and they do all these different things and we are born here and we can't make it happen. So when you talk about coming here and you talk about language barriers, you talk about all the other money barrier, how do you keep going? What's the inspiration to get to the other side? Let me ask that question.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say for me, and a lot of other folks like me, I would say from talking to them, one is just wanting to do something for your family. Like having seen my mom suffer for so many years, having seen my father struggle, and then especially after my brother passed away and then my father passed away when we were in college, that pressure of being like, wow, if I don't do something, the whole family's going to fall apart. There's some of that. I think, you know, I was wearing a different shirt and then I saw your beautiful dashiki. I went and got mine as well. And the reason I did that is actually culture, in my opinion, is a phenomenal anchor. Like, because what culture tells you is, and I was always reminded this by my parents, is you're part of a long line of geniuses, overcomers, and there's a word in our language called jigna. Jigna is a warrior in my culture that can never be defeated. And it's the ultimate compliment to be called a jigna, where I come from. And you can anchor yourself and connect yourself to millennia-old roots of inspiration. And I believe that is true, right? And so that also helps you not feel alone when you're struggling. Like when you feel like you're just by yourself and everything's going against you, you feel like you have a community around you. I think community is critical. So I figured those kind of things. All that being said, it was rough at the beginning, man. Like I almost got expelled from school a couple of times. I felt probably the thing that people don't understand that is the hardest thing, especially where we were resettled, was in a upper middle class, mostly Caucasian community. You just feel invisible a lot of the time. Like you don't have value. Like people see right through you. It's not that someone came and punched you in the face. It might be that nobody invited you to their birthday party. That wounds you over time because it tells you you have zero value.
Home Team Inspection Service is changing the way agents and clients experience home inspections. Their team-based model, streamlined scheduling, and bundled packages, including home inspection warranties, make the process smoother from contract to closing. And with Pay at Close available in many locations, you can give your buyers more peace of mind with less upfront cost. Choose the team that works with yours. Visit HomeTeam.com to learn more.
So talk a little bit about that, Maui. Like you've done a lot of work studying human resilience, human motivation, and how people accomplish great things and sharing that predominantly with teens, I think, around the country. How would you put that to our listeners where sometimes the biggest challenge is they haven't been able to sell a home or their investment went sideways or they're trying to learn something new. When you think about adults stepping into a space of thinking differently than the way they've thought before and having to change their relationship with money, what role does sort of this idea of culture and anchoring and honoring and reframing your mindset play?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot there, Bo. And one of my favorite tools I'll share with your listeners is I keep this plant right next to me by my desk. And the reason I keep it here is that, you know, we know that if this plant does not get sunlight, it will wither away and die. It can't go through the process of photosynthesis and create energy. Its cells will just perish. Your listeners are the same way. Unless your listeners get sunlight, unless each of you here gets sunlight, you will wither away and die. That's one of the things that's so powerful about this podcast that you have together is it creates sunlight for others and for each other. So my company's done a lot of research on what gives adults sunlight. It usually comes in four different categories. One is community, relationship. So I'm sure the four of you have really benefited from just knowing each other. It uplifts you. It kind of gives you some strength. So we all need those relationships that will build us up, right? Another source is creativity. So something like as beautiful as the shirts we're wearing or playing a guitar or painting. For some people, it could be woodworking. Let's say you're somebody out there, Bo, use example. Someone has not sold a home and their bills are tight. If all they're doing is sitting and looking at the computer screen and thinking about how do I sell that home, they're not going to have the energy required to take on life's challenges. They need to get some sunlight for themselves. They need to connect. The four sources of sunlight that have energized me throughout my life that I train on a lot are one, relationships, two, creativity. The third one is experiences. So something as simple like driving an hour and doing something that's not in the normal scope of things and walk along a riverbank. And the final one is self-care. Right? Like the exercise, meditation. We actually run workshops. We've run workshops at McKinsey. We've run workshops at BCG and all these places where we ask people to share their sunlight activities. And it's pretty amazing. All parts of the country, when you look at the data, it ends up being in those four categories. So I tell people you will not find the light by endlessly staring at darkness. And I know that from a personal experience because I was depressed for a whole year. I didn't realize it. I actually need medication or counseling or something. But in my culture, we don't really go to counselors. And I would endlessly look at the darkness, all the things that were wrong, all the things that were so terrible that were depressing me, and not and wondering why I wasn't feeling any better. And to the point that, you know, if it hadn't been for my mom, I wouldn't have considered living anymore possibly, right? And so you got to have some source of light. You can't just overcome with nothing, okay? You got to have something that uplifts you. And again, I hope this podcast can be a tremendous example of that. People tune in and they hear some positivity, but they also get companionship from y'all. They know y'all because they are relating with y'all. You're telling stories and they know who you are. That can be a powerful source of sunlight. There's some times in our lives where we forgot what light looks like. You're in that dark tunnel and you can't even, you don't even remember what light. People are like, oh, can you see the light at the end of the tunnel? It's like, no, I forgot what light looked like. That's how I felt when my brother passed away. And that's when you have to have courage. That's what courage is. When you still stick with your values and you work hard and you do the things that matter to you and you try to be the good person God has created you to be, even though you feel like you forgot what light is like, right? Like, and we've all had those moments that are tough, right? I had them in my business. There was a time when I ran my business. Everyone sees the success now when I sold the ACT and, you know, we were growing 1,000% in 3 years. Go a few years back, I literally had gone down to no staff. I had shut down my office and I was literally looking to switch cell phone plans because it would save $3 a month. $36 a year. That's how bad it got, okay? And you're like, and any entrepreneur has been there, and we gotta be honest about that. But there's also, you know, that makes it so much more powerful when you actually find some level of success, right?
I always think of it like in your business, there were sort of two main, I don't know, there might have been way more, but two big turning points that I have been exposed to. And maybe you could tell us the first about this transition from being a speaker and an author, where it was all personal production, to trying to create an ed tech company. And what inspired that? And how did you make that transition?
But wait, can I ask a question before you answer that to shift to that? You're a speaker and all of that. I want to ask a way more basic question. How did you get on Oprah?
You want to hear the real deal story? Here we go. Okay. So I'm 24 years old. All right.
Yeah.
Oprah is at the height, like Midas touch, like boom, you go on Oprah, it's over. Like everything's good, right? And I just started speaking. I was relatively broke, but not poor.
He was broke, but not poor. He was leveraging that speaking thing. He was getting those speeches all across the country, running to little schools and stuff.
But Bo, first when you were speaking, I literally had a woman pay me $5 for a speech. I mean, you see crazy stuff when you're speaking. You're like, damn, bro, like I came from another state. You paid me $5? One guy just gave him his money back. I'm like, give me a break. So people are like, you got to get Oprah. So I'm like, how do you do this? They're like, hey, you got to get a publicist, pay $10,000 a month. I think that was my entire revenue for my first year when I was 23. It was $10,000 for the year, okay? And you got to hire these publicists for 6 months to get a chance to get an Oprah. So you want to know what I did? I emailed all my friends. Bo, you might have gotten this email. Emailed all my friends. And I told them, here's the comment box on Oprah's website. Go on there. Tell her about my book. Tell her that you think I should be on the story because this is her kind of story. So we did that. Nothing happens. A year later, I'm driving on 290. I'll never forget this moment, which is a big highway outside of Chicago. And I usually don't pick up my phone. I get a phone call. It's a producer for the Oprah Winfrey Show. And she says, about a year ago, like 50 people emailed us on the same day. We're like, who is this Maui guy? And we looked up your story and we just had to wait for the right episode. So we've been waiting a year for an episode on people who found success in this country. But this is one of the top things I always tell kids as well is in social emotional learning, we call it hitting your turbo button. Like everyone has a turbo button in their heart. Instead of saying, I can't get on Oprah Show because I'm broke, I'm going to take whatever action I can, which is absolutely essential in the field of real estate. You get a lot of no's. Yeah, you need the sunlight to have the energy. Once you have the energy, you got to hit your turbo button all the time, basically. And so here's the amazing part. Here's the God part. That same exact week, I was negotiating my book contract for LeBron & Company. I had no idea I was going to be talking with them the year previous when I tried to get on the show. I called them up and I said, hey, Lil Brown, Time Warner, I'm about to be on Oprah next week. They tripled the offer. Now, the reason that matters isn't because I got more money for my advance. For anyone who wants to be an author, the biggest indication you have that your book's going to get marketing is the advance you get from the publisher. If you publish a book and they only spent $1 on your book, they're not going to market it. If you publish a book and they spent $400,000 on it, someone's going to lose their job if the book doesn't sell. So you just need the advance to be as big as possible to ensure that they're not going to throw you in the like, oh, we're producing 100 books. So Oprah was completely like turbo button, like throw it out to the universe and see what happens. Yeah. And it changed my life.
And what was the book about that you were telling her that you wanted to talk about?
So the book was Of Beatles and Angels, A Boy's Remarkable Journey from a Refugee Camp to Harvard. So I told my story, coming from the camp, coming to the States, all the different stuff, getting to Harvard where I met people like Bo. And to get to Bo's question, that's where the speaking kind of took off. I started speaking everywhere. What I didn't realize, you know that expression, beware what you wish for, that it may come true? It became a nightmare. Like I was speaking 130 times a year. It's like that agent who's like, I can't wait to sell a bunch of houses. And then they have like 49 open houses in like 2 days. And they're like, my life sucks. I have no friends. And some things about it are good, but you realize that your life has blown up. So I knew it was a terrible moment for me when someone I cared about was really sick. And my schedule was so tight that I could not even visit them. And I was like, how is that success? That people you care about desperately need, I'm so successful that when people I care about are about to die, I can't help them. That's how successful I am. I mean, that's ludicrous, right? Nobody would say that's successful, right? So then I realized it's a treadmill. I do got to share one thing about speaking though, because everyone asked me, like all these people always ask me, how do I speak? And I wonder if you can relate to this in the real estate industry. What they don't think about is when they're pricing their product, here's what they don't think about. They'd be like, well, Maui, I asked them, how much are you going to charge? They're like, $1,000 a speech. I'm getting $1,000 for an hour of my time. I'm like, okay, that's cool. But what happens if you get 100 of those in a year? See, they don't ask that question. They're like, what do you mean if I get 100? Well, let's say you got 100 of those, that you got 100 speeches at $1,000 a piece. They'd be like, well, I make $100,000. I'm like, but you'd also have to sign 100 contracts with 100 different entities, which takes time. You'd have to do accounting for 100 different organizations. You might have to fly to 70 different places. It's a nightmare. It's much better to speak 7 times for $15,000. And you'll actually have time to think and all this stuff. But people don't do, that's one of my favorite things to ask any entrepreneur early on is, what happens if you got 100 of what you wanted? And once they think it through, they realize it'd be a nightmare.
You talk about like energy and sunshine. You are infectious. And so your ability to speak and speak, is this something you've learned? Have you always been this charismatic and happy? And because it's truly infectious. I'm over here just like buzzing like, man, I like this guy.
Hey, I appreciate that. I was actually extremely shy in middle school, especially a lot of high school, because quite frankly, I didn't feel I had value. And if you don't feel like you have value, your natural light cannot shine. You're just like trying to get emotional oxygen to walk into a place and just have value. So you can't even think about all this. And I was lucky enough to have enough growth experiences in college and shortly after that kind of helped me grow into a lot of this. But no, I appreciate you saying that, by the way.
He was a shy little boy in freshman and sophomore year of college. We were cleaning bathrooms. He couldn't even figure out there were these senior girls had a big crush on Maui that would come over every night to study. And he didn't even realize that these girls liked him.
Like, Maui just didn't understand. Like, she likes you. I'm like, really?
He didn't understand how like magnetic he was. He was just like, I gotta go back in my room and do my stuff.
I was like, Bo, I think she's just interested in the science of the atmosphere. That's what she came here to discuss. What are you talking about? That class you're taking? What are you talking about, Bo? And he was like trying to.
And you had to coach him through it, right?
I'd help coach him up. You know, I coach him up.
You were talking earlier when we started, and you were talking about the path to wealth. You were talking about money earlier when we first got on, before we started recording. And I got deep into it. I said, hey, don't talk about that. I want to hear the whole story.
Yeah.
Where you were talking about, go just get the whole path. I believe a lot of people, they come from a place where they don't have and some people still don't have. And they're in that certain despair. Just a mindset to transition from money meaning one thing at one point, then another thing at another point. Some people get trapped in that place of what money means to them, and they can never get past that place. So consequently, they never grow wealth.
It's true. I mean, look, one of the most profound realizations I had in my life was I asked myself, when were you truly the happiest? And it was, I mean, it's going to make me cry almost, but it's when I was broke, living in Section 8, but I was hanging with my brother and we were just hanging out like as 10-year-old kids, like riding our bike. Or this idea, and even right now, I have a spreadsheet that I look at, but I have one tab that says facts. And on that, I have all the different ways that I have wealth that has nothing to do with money, like relationships, health, all these things that really, when you look at it, if we were to appreciate them and really look at them, we would see that money is just one tiny sliver of looking at the wealth that we have in our lives, right? It just happens to be the one that culture looks at all the time, right? And it was a breakdown moment for me when I realized that my desire to speak and do all these things had basically led to a breakdown in my personal life. I was making more money than I had before, but I couldn't do basic things in my personal life. And my health was suffering. I was eating all the worst foods going from city to city. I wasn't working out. Is this common in your industry where people chase something and then they try to get it and then they get it and then they're like, what just happened in my life?
I don't know if I don't know if people sit down and say, what happened in my life? I believe some people, they chase it so much when they get it, nothing else in their life really matters. It's just that they are past where they were before and they know that they don't want to go back there. So they just keep doing whatever they're doing to make sure that they can keep making money to do what they do right now, to have that status of right now. And quality of life, I'm not sure if that really matters that much. I'm just being...
Well, I mean, what you're saying, Maui, resonates a lot because to your point of, you know, you running and running, and I was so busy going from city to city to speak. And remember, I missed Emmerich's 60th birthday because I didn't know what city I was in. I went to the airport. I thought I was in Austin. I was in Minneapolis. I had been in too many cities at one time. And so you're doing so much of the one thing, like you said, that's not a version of success. Because to your point, when there's something important to you that you want to do, I couldn't even make it. I had to turn around and go home. And so that's not success. And it is a fact of something that people are chasing. But to your point, Emmerich, the reason I'm chasing it is because I'm scared to be broke.
Right.
Right. Like I'm afraid of being broke. And I don't want to sit down and not get paid because for the love of God, I definitely don't want to go back to the food stamp line. You know.
So another thing I noticed early on when I was speaking was I joined something in it was in Hyde Park in Chicago called the National African American Speaking Association. We met every Saturday at a hotel and we would share best practices on speaking. You know what I noticed in pretty early on was at the end of the day, we were talking about getting speeches for $500, $1,000. I went to the regular speaking association, if you call it, or the one that was not for African Americans. And I would see, in my opinion, speakers that were 20% of the quality getting speeches for 10,000, 15,000, 20,000. That was my first indication that like where you live, where you are, not skill sometimes, because everyone got fascinated with Les Brown. Oh, you see Les making 50,000, 60,000 per speech. Not a lot of Les Browns out there. There's a lot more people trying to get $100, $200 to give a speech. And yeah. One of the things I realized early on is I can do the same work and get paid $20,000, $25,000, $15,000, or get paid $500, $1,000. And it was tough for me to see how different it was by race at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big breakthrough, though, for you, right? When you decided to do less and charge more. And I remember how afraid Maui was. I'm going to lose these clients. I'm going to lose people. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a very, I think, real feeling. Like, I've built this base. I've become beloved. I'm doing this thing. But what about if I walk away? What would happen?
So, you want to hear the gangster thing I did? So, I was like, at some point, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to change the whole game. I'm going to make it so I'm only going to speak if your entire town reads the book of Be Dozen Angels. So, like, you go then into, like, a $50,000, $60,000 speech. And they're buying 5,000 copies of your book. I'm no longer a speaker. I'm a big literacy. I'm a literacy initiative that unlocks literacy in your community. In business school, they call that changing your frame of reference. And I'm guessing a lot of folks in your industry have to ask, what's my current frame of reference for myself? Am I selling homes? Am I deploying capital? Am I doing this? But the thing that really took things to a whole different level was where I scaled myself was I got... Through speaking, I spoke to the largest online high school in the country. I'm going to let your listeners guess for a second. In 2010, how many students do you think went to the largest online high school in the United States? I'll give you 3 seconds to think. If you said over 200,000, you were correct. Mind-boggling, right? Over 200,000. So I spoke there. I saw thousands of teachers. I'm like, I got really curious. And I said, how can you have an online school that has thousands of teachers? And then I looked at the school and their AP scores were actually higher than the state average. This is the Florida Virtual School. So I became good friends with that CEO. And probably I've made so many mistakes as an entrepreneur. Probably the smartest thing I ever did that led to the current financial wealth I have right now is when I saw something that didn't make sense, I got curious. I said, wait a second, let me understand this. And let me understand the business model. Oh, the business model is that if I were to create a class with you guys and a student completes my class, I can get paid, let's just pick a number, $30 per student. That means that if I have 10,000 students take this class, I can make $300,000 without leaving my home. I was like, wait, that's a different model. So I created one test class with them. It ended up winning the highest award in the industry called the Cody Award from the Software Industry Association of America. Once I saw what was possible there, I switched from a personal leadership company that was anchored in me speaking or us having books into an ed tech company. And that was, again, I made a lot of foolish business moves. That was the single best move I made in terms of strategy. And what that meant was I could build out an ed tech team. The biggest contribution Bo made to me in terms of my business journey was he helped me realize the power of team. He said, right now you got to invest. He said, you need to hire a COO, pay that CEO more than you think you should be paying that COO and give that CEO a lot of responsibility. And that was, I hired a woman named Molly. She was better at management than I was. She was better at so many things than I was, which allowed me to then go do all these other things. And then the part that would blow that my brother and I could have never imagined was this. When you're used to working for money, like I work an hour, I get $7 for cleaning your place or whatever it is, you don't understand the power of streams of income, that you can generate a stream of income through your business. So let's say my business is making $1 million a year, right? The idea that I can then get a multiple on that of 10 and sell that business. I'm just using hypothetical numbers here. I can sell that business for $10 million. Was a level of wealth building that I had no frame of reference for understanding that. I only thought of wealth building as I can get a better job. Or if I'm lucky, I'll get paid $100,000 a year someday. That would be like the highest of the highest when I was a kid that could be possible for someone like me. And the idea that you can build streams of income and sell that stream of income and a team to somebody else was another massive quantum jump. And then once I did that, I was able to move into the world of investment. So right now, for example, I loan money. I never would have believed this either, that I would be in a position now where I loan money to people who are really good at loaning money to real estate companies. And my money is senior secured. Like if they don't pay us, we're going to take whatever they're working on. And I can pretty reliably get 10 to 15% interest doing that while I'm sitting here talking to you. And I don't have to do it with one place. I can have like 6 different people working for me. Bo and I are members of a group called 3i that helps put some of these groups deals together. Even when I was a student at Harvard, I never would have imagined that this kind of business existed. I just thought, oh, you go, you work at a consulting company, or you go become a doctor, or you go do this. But the idea that you can move money around and build things and sell income streams, it just was astounding to me to learn about all this.
Well, if you had to say, I am extremely passionate about this, what would you say you're extremely passionate about?
And it's going to sound funny to you because I haven't talked about it. At the end of the day, I'm still extremely passionate about helping youth unlock their potential. That's okay. What I was put on this planet to do. The reason that my company grew like it did was because I really wanted to be there for kids and do something that had never been done for them. And remembering this guy who passed away and everything he taught me when he was 17. And we became the best in the world at it, objectively, because there was so much passion. And now I'm in that in-between phase where I'm doing investments. I'm spending time with my 4 kids and my amazing wife. I will find new ways to unlock the potential of youth. Like that's my ultimate kind of, I love the investment side. I love the money side. I love all this other side, but finding creative and interesting ways to really help youth unlock their potential is still my primary reason I'm here, I would say.
Can you talk a little bit, Maui? Just we're getting to the end of our time, but I think it'd be great when you think back across your life and the orientations to money at each stage, as a refugee, a new refugee to America, as a young person growing up in an economically challenged home, to being at Harvard, you still didn't have anything, but you were exposed to all this wealth around you, to starting a business from scratch and being an entrepreneur, to seeing success at that, to building a company, going from being an individual producer, time and talent for money, to time, talent, money, building the enterprise, to then finally selling that enterprise and becoming an investor. You've seen money from so many different perspectives. How has your relationship with wealth and money evolved or changed over time?
It's a really powerful question, Bo. One of the things I was thinking when you were talking about was, you just don't know what you don't know at different stages. And the way you know is to be introduced to it, connect with people, have people who are kind enough to mentor you, put yourself in different situations. But I would say early on, when I was growing up from first grade, 12th grade, I was just used to not having a lot of money. That was like to the point of, you know, if the school had an ice cream social and needed a dollar, I wouldn't ask my parents for the dollar because I knew they didn't have the dollar, right? Like I wasn't going to do that. And so that's a massive, it's actually been quite difficult for me to accept the level of abundance I have right now. And through some counseling, I realized that I was so used to strip mining myself and basically like extricating myself and just kind of like putting myself through the ringer again and again, that I was still continuing that behavior in ways that were not productive, even when I didn't have to. I think that's one, unfortunately, one of the long-term effects there. Mm-hmm. Something simple, like being able to just enjoy your money a little bit, is actually quite difficult for me. Like, the person who has no money is much more likely to enjoy their few shekels than I might do, because I'm thinking about, oh, I should be contributing that over here. I should be helping this person over here. I got family back home in Ethiopia that needs help with.
Since you have that issue, send your money to me and I'll enjoy it for you.
I love this guy, man. I love this guy. So, Bo, that's actually, maybe we should end on this though, Bo. When I got Oprah, and I actually had the highest income year of my life up to that point, where through speaking, the Oprah stuff, the book stuff, I think in today's money, it was something like, all of a sudden I had like 400,000, 500,000, okay? Which for a kid who most recently was just like, had nothing. So at the end of the year, I had basically nothing. What do y'all think happened? What do you think happened to the money?
You enjoyed it.
No, you gave it away.
Taxes!
Everyone is correct except for Emmerich, okay? If only I would have had you, Emmerich, okay? Here's what I did with it, okay? Taxes definitely beat you up, man. Like, you, the first time you have to pay taxes, it's a, what? Yeah. What's going to happen if I don't pay this, right? Like, you're worried about that. I always told myself, well, if I get money, I'm not going to be like those folks who win the lottery and blow it all. You know, I was always good at math. I took a lot of calculus classes. I blew it on stupid investments. I invested in office space I didn't need. I hired a bunch of people to do really dumb stuff when I look at it in perspective. And the biggest lesson, and I wish, Emmerich, you and I would have been around. We would have gone to Bali and been sipping Mai Tais and chilling, or I would have bought a Ferrari at least at the end of the year and have something. I realized at the end of the year, my biggest enemy with money is myself, because I have so many ideas and a lot of them are really bad. And it's really hard to admit that and acknowledge that. But for some of us, we blow it all on materialistic stuff. For others of us, we blow it all on investments we shouldn't have made. I basically have created some structures to protect myself from myself, mainly like creating accounts that I can't touch no matter what. But Emmerich, now thank you. Maybe if I ever struggle to spend the money, I'm going to call 1-800-Emmerich and you can spend that on my behalf, right?
We can go buy some koi fish.
Yeah, Emmerich into the
there
fish.
There we go, right?
That's a special space. So Maui, thank you very much for being with us. We may have to have you back because I think we were just getting to some of the good stuff. We might have to have a Maui part two. But from scarcity to abundance, from tragedy to inspiration, to finding your sunlight, to changing your frame of reference, to figuring out how to hit your turbo button to break through the challenges that face us. Thank you for sharing your time with us. Is there any last thing you'd like to leave our listeners with as we close out this podcast?
Oh, yeah. No, I just want to say thank you for creating this space, Bo. I think it's powerful. I think it's important to give people hope, inspiration, bring people together. And don't ever get down when things aren't going well. That's one of the things from my story. If people want to know more about me, I'm at maui.com, M-A-W-I.com. I am coming out with that Find Your Sunlight book in the next few months, so you can enjoy that too. But I want to come back. We got a lot more to talk about, man. We got a lot to do. All right? We got a lot to do. Thank you.
Just getting started. So thank you very much. Appreciate it, Maui. And don't forget to check out Maui's book of Beatles and Angels. And you can check him out also at maui.com. Take care.
Follow the
Color of Money podcast today and get notified when new episodes are released weekly.
Be part of this transformative listening experience.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. The views, thoughts, and opinions of the guest represent those of the guest and not Keller Williams Realty LLC and its affiliates, and should not be construed as financial, economic, legal, tax, or other advice. This podcast is provided without any warranty or guarantee of its accuracy, completeness, timeliness, or results from using the information.